You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2018 Tour de France in association with RAFA. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, RAFA exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport. Today we are in Carcassonne.
Hopefully it's going to be me who's going to win today or someone else on the team. I know me and Magnus have the opportunity to go in the breakaway, so we'll try to be in the front at the beginning and look for the breaks, and then hopefully we can stay away and take another win.
Well, we're in a bustly Carcassonne bar, and we were played in there by Michael Valgren, who you spoke to, Francois, at the start this morning.
Absolutely. Another, could I say, lucky moment?
Or Nostradamus moment.
Absolutely.
So he was, he featured in the big break today, didn't he? And his teammate, Magnus Cort, won the stage. And it was another very impressive performance from Astana, because they won, of course, on Mond the day before with Omar Fraile. So it was not a stage that created an awful lot of drama and certainly didn't do anything for the GC, but it was an entertaining finale. Lionel, can you give us the tale of the attack, please, or have I just done that?
You kind of edged me into the gutter there.
Not a lot
of road left for me there, really.
Oh, but, well, you know, let's move on then.
Well, okay.
No, come on.
No, there was another big break today, wasn't there, on the stage. Stage 15 from Miau to Carcassonne. One of the three homes of Cassoulet, really, along with Castelnaudry and Foix. We may sample some Cassoulet this evening.
Stop dribbling, Lionel.
But actually, should probably mention last night's meal, because there was a sort of Nostradamus moment in the Cycling Podcast car, because Francois and I were travelling with David Luxton, very good friend of the podcast, assistant to the podcast.
DS,
sports director of the podcast, David Luxton. And he kind of asked me what I was missing about home now we've been on the road a couple of weeks. And I said, I'd love a curry. I'd really like a curry. And last night we were staying with a friend of Francois's deep in the massive Centrale countryside in a gorgeous 12th century, 15th century chateau.
Yeah, 12th to 18th century. The tower 12 and the rest of the building was 18th century.
And I was kind of thinking, well, we may get quite a rich French dinner here, but no, we were served a chicken curry with a sag paneer and some rice.
Oh, it was absolutely delicious.
Absolutely hit the spot.
Peter and Virginie.
Absolutely.
We'll post some pictures of the place and tell you how you can book there, because they're not on any kind of the popular hotel websites or search engines. It's a little hidden gem, and it really is hidden. I mean, it's very, very remote in there, but it was beautiful, and we had a very pleasant evening indeed.
We did, but to the stage. Stage 15, the last one before the second rest day. A big break again. Lots of very strong riders in it. And really the action caught fire on the big climb, the first category climb, which was 45 plus kilometres to go. There was a move by Fabien Grelier and Julien Bernard, the son of Jean-François Bernard. They were then away. And then Rafał Majka came out of the break up to them and passed them on the climb and was looking good, but then was caught, and the final section of the race was decided by eight riders: Majka, Calmejean, Bauke Mollema of Trek Segafredo, who won the equivalent stage in Le Puy-en-Velay last year, Domenico Pozzovivo and Jon Izagirre of Bahrain Merida were in there, Michael Valgren and Magnus Cort Nielsen of Astana were in there, and Bernard's teammate Tom Schuins of Trek Segafredo was in there. And it really came down to a bit of cat and mouse in the final 8 kilometres. And then the winning move, it went in a fairly straightforward way. Bauke Mollema went, Magnus Cort went with him, and Jon Izagirre was the other rider. And that trio went, and the others, well, because of the teammates behind, there was really only Lilian Calmejean who had the strong incentive to chase, and he couldn't do it on his own. And coming into the final kilometre, you would think that it was going to be a straightforward win for Magnus Cort, and so it proved. Izagirre had tried something, but completely the wrong point. Bauke Mollema really had nothing to offer, and Nielsen, a very good sprinter, has won 2 stages of the Vuelta in the past, including in Madrid, took Astana's second consecutive stage win. So happy days for the Danish Astana riders.
Some breaking news as we stop recording tonight. It was being reported that Gianni Moscon, the team Sky rider, had been kicked off the race for an altercation with a Fortuneo rider, we don't know who yet, in the first 800 metres of today's stage. There are reports that he punched a rider and he's been disqualified from the race. We gather Nicola Portal and Dave Brailsford were summoned to the race organisation afterwards, the commissars, and yeah, it's been confirmed now, Moss gone out the race, and not the first incident he's been involved in.
No, there was a racist comment toward Kevin Razor. There was then the incident with Sebastian Reichenbach, which was, you know, not proven, where Moscon was alleged to have knocked Reichenbach off as kind of retribution for Reichenbach blowing the whistle on Moscon for the racist language he'd used towards Kevin Razor. That case not proven. Then, of course, there was the World Championships last year where Moscon held on to a team car for really a very unacceptable amount of time in a key part of the race, and now this incident today. So the details are very sketchy. It's difficult to be kind of judge, jury and executioner based on the announcement that he's been disqualified, but there's quite a charge sheet here, isn't there? And I don't think many people are terribly surprised that Moscon is a rush of blood to the head, but a rush of blood to the head in the first 800 metres of a stage, extraordinary.
I don't think there's any justification for violence, but the circumstances, as you say, the first kilometre of the stage seems extraordinary. And at some point, you know, he's a young Italian rider in his first Tour de France with a big job to do. You cannot behave like that, and he's done it a few times now, and really, if Team Sky don't sack him at this stage, frankly, then I don't know, you know, what he would have to do.
I agree with that, but if they sacked him, somebody else would just pick him up, maybe on less wages. I mean,
that's not a reason not to sack him.
No, I agree with you, but the weird kind of rules of the peloton are, I think it's very unlikely Team Sky would sack him for just being disqualified from a race. I mean, they'll probably look at that as the punishment, and that could well cost Team Sky over the last week of the race. I'm not saying that's the right course of action, but I can't see them sacking him.
Well, in French law, I don't know about British law, but I'm sure it's about the same, in probably even more strict. But you know, there are lots of grounds for Team Sky to sack a rider. You know, for professional fault. I mean, punching another rider at the beginning of a stage of the Tour de France, I mean, is a serious offence. We don't know exactly the details. I called Nicolas Portal, who didn't know the decision yet, but he sounded embarrassed. Obviously, they've been watching the videos of the incident, and if the organisers decided that there was enough grounds to ban Jenny Moscon from the Tour de France, it is very serious, and it would be very, you know, unjustifiable not to, at least not to sanction him within the team one way or another, to suspend him from some time at least.
It's very unusual as well, you know, for this to happen. It's quite an extreme case. Moscon, of course, was punished by the team last year for the incident involving Razor, the racist language. He was apparently put on a diversity awareness course, which I think happened in October. He was suspended by the team for 6 weeks, but he must also at that point have been given a final warning, surely.
Well, I don't know whether that's the case or not. Now, I've just said I can't see Team Sky sacking him, and you two kind of disagree. I mean, I'm not saying there aren't grounds to do so, but I just think that the sort of the DNA of Team Sky is performance comes first, and if he can continue to do a job on the bike going forward, if they feel that they can, this might well be the final wake-up call for him, I think Team Sky, they look to me like the sort of organisation that would give as many chances as they possibly could to a very talented rider.
Here's something that from the statement that Team Sky put out after the Razor incident last year. Gianni knows that there is no excuse for his behaviour and that any repeat will result in termination of his contract. So, okay, they're talking about a use of racist language there. They may look at a punch and violence as a different type of offence, a different category of offence. Who knows? We're getting into realms of speculation now. The news is that Gianni Moscon is out of the Tour de France and Team Sky are down to 7 riders.
There might also be sanctions from the UCI. I mean, this sort of behaviours, I mean, it's not only, you know, it's all very well to be banned from a race, but I mean, there might be legal implications. I mean, and in the same time, I'm sure sure that in UCI rulings and rules in general that there are, you know, there are probably sanctions, you know, to be you know, taken against a rider who punches another one. So let's wait and see. But I'm sure, you know, Gianni Moscon will not stay only banned from the Tour de France, but there's bound to be more.
Yeah, the UCI were really weak on Moscon's previous misdemeanour. Misdemeanour, that's the wrong word. I mean, I don't want to lighten what Moscon did last time or this time. But they were weak on it. They left it to the team, really, and said, well, if the team are going to suspend him, then that's kind of good enough for us. That's punishment enough. And, of course, Moscon came back and won the Italian Time Trial Championship. You know, he did miss some races, we gather. I think the UCI has to take the lead on this kind of thing and just say, no, enough is enough, and take it out of Team Sky's hands and impose something on him.
It was very interesting that the makeup of that break in the end, because there were three teams with two riders each, barring Merida, whose riders apparently have been advised by their manager Brent Copeland, friend of the podcast Brent Copeland, to stay as far away as possible from Team Sky riders. Well, they did a good job of that today, getting in the breakaway, didn't they? Because there weren't likely to be any Team Sky riders in the breakaway.
No, very true. Having said that, as we drove along the Oar course today, the Team Sky bus was being very closely marked by the Bahrain Merida bus on the motorway.
Strange tactics by the team buses there. But the other team with two riders there, Astana, Bahrain Merida, and Trek Segafredo. And I think, you know, Bakumalama attacked, but he was the wrong guy to have in that final move. I'm not really sure how good a sprinter Tom Squeens is, but I guarantee he's a better finisher than Bakumalama.
And apparently, it was a planned move by Trek Segafredo, who missed out, who won a stage with John Degenkolb, obviously, but missed out shortly, you know, finishing second and now having a third place with Bakumalama. And, well, I talked to Steven de Jong there, team manager, who explained that actually that apparently to send Julien Bernard up front in the climb and then to have a second attack by Mollema had been planned. So let's listen to what he had to say.
Well, another day with Trek to the front and just a little bit shorter again today.
Yes, it was quite hard when we got the composition after the top of the climb with Mike in front, and then Toms and Bauke were there, but there was also a strong block of Astana with Valgren and Kurt Nielsen. So,
well, Julien was first on the move on the Pic du Nord, and then Bauke was just behind. Well, I suppose it was a planned move.
Yeah, it was a planned move because we didn't want to make the climb easy there, because also Sagan was in that group. And yeah, that's of course a guy you won't take over the top towards the finish. So
Bauke tried his best, he attacked.
Yeah, no, he attacked, and I think that was the only thing he could do. And yeah, team did well.
You've already got a stage win behind you. What's the objective now?
Well, more stage wins, but yesterday we were third, and today we were third, so we're not succeeding, but we keep on trying.
Well, as you say there, Francois, Trek Segafredo had a plan and didn't really execute it. Astana had a plan and did execute it. We heard in the press conference, Rich, Magnus Cort say that Lars Michelsen went to his room last night with the road book and talked through the tactics for the day. And obviously we've heard from Michael Valgren pretty much revealing what they were going to do, but having the plan and then pulling it off are two quite different things. But they're obviously on cloud nine after winning yesterday. And at the finish, I spoke to Lars Michelsen, Danish sports director, about having two Danes in the break for Astana today. This morning, Michael Valgren said that he and Magnus were going to go in the break and they were going to win the stage. So they were obviously confident and that was the plan. But it's not always works out like that.
No, that's true. But I mean, when you are on the world's biggest cycling race and you are competing against the biggest names in the world, and you have a clear vision of what you're going to do, you have in your back pocket, in your history pocket, you have or Omloop Het Nieuwsblad or Amstel Gold Race or two stages in the Vuelta a España, and then, you know, you can build up this self-confidence, and I wouldn't say it half of it, but it's a great deal of going out to execute your plan. That's your self-confidence.
So did you feel confident when it all came back together after the climb and there were the eight in front? Because you weren't the only team with two riders in there. They still had to execute the finish.
For us, it was a perfect constellation, of course. And the biggest battle was actually going up the last 5Ks of the climb to eliminate all possible sprinters who could be a threat to us. And I mean, that was what I did mostly. I was pushing the guys to keep on going hard, and then okay, it made me happy that Micah tried to go across and Mollema putting the hammer down. Just, you know, it actually helped our mission. But they were in the same boat. They were also warning not to have any big sprinters. But of course, they probably had a thought about my two guys, saying, okay, they can actually sprint these two guys, but that's too late now.
In terms of the tactic, I was slightly surprised that Magnus was the one that went first. I would have thought Valgren would go and save Magnus just in case it all came back together, but perhaps that's why I'm not a sports director.
Yeah. No, so, I mean, part of it is the ambience between us and the camaradeship and being, you know, doesn't matter who wins. At one point when Magnus, he did the first move, they were nearly coming together, but then he put down the hammer again. I said to Valgren at that point, I said, Valgren, you stay put now, you stay ready, because that's what normally happens. But then Magnus was flying, and he provoked his own victory.
The other two put Magnus on the front quite a long way out, but were you still confident because of his sprint?
Yeah, because Magnus, I mean, he winning sprints in the Vuelta means that he's a sprinter, but he's also a climber. And he today, what I saw on the Pic Noir there, it was incredible, the legs he had. So suddenly I was surprised. I would have expected Valgren to be the better climber, but that just gave me confidence about the whole outcome.
And coming after Omar's victory yesterday, it must be incredible. And to be Danish with Astana this evening, not a bad evening ahead.
No, not a bad evening at all. No, we are very happy.
Easy when you know how, I guess. Lars Michaelsen there, plenty to celebrate this evening. But Richard, as you said, all the teams will have had a plan of some kind, because that's how the Tour de France works. It's just we hear about the plans when the stage victory is delivered at the end.
One plan that worked perfectly, I talked to Philippe Mauduit this morning, the UAE Emirates team director, who took a nice picture of my recorder with their rider Roberto Ferrari, who have the same haircut as Daniel Freeb and some other, could I say, well, a very strange hairstyle. And Philippe Mauduit told me, the plan today, nothing. We're not sending anybody in the break. We're not expecting anything from this stage. So we just rest. And they did, well, except that Daniel Martin, at one stage in the climb, when he was between the GC peloton and the breakaway, attacked for no obvious reason. I mean, I don't know. He was probably in a hurry to get to the rest day or something. It was pretty strange.
He races with a lot of oomph, a lot of panache, really, Dan Martin. I mean, it's an opportunity for him to do something, and maybe, who knows, he might have dragged a few people clear, or he might have sparked something. Of course, yesterday his chances were dashed because he had a puncture right at the foot of the final climb, and he in fact said a thank you on Twitter to Adam Yates, who I think sort of tried to pace him back up and limit his losses. He's still in 10th place overall, the Pyrenees are to come, and he may well be thinking of trying to leapfrog a few people, get into the top five.
Another very strange move was the one by Lilian Calmejean, who attacked on the first climb of the day and embarked on what might have been a 100-something break on his own. And well, obviously he surrendered, halfway through the stage, remained in the leading group. But at the time when he needed that little bit, that extra kick to go with Mollema, Izagirre, and Cort, well, he had nothing left, no fuel left in the tank, and it was also another disappointed day for Direct Energy, who had five guys in the break yesterday and didn't do anything. And this year, and this time again, Calmejean has to be content with finishing in the top 10.
To be fair, though, I wouldn't have fancied Calmejean's chances in a sprint finish against Magnus Cort anyway. I think once he got up the road, even in the eight-man group, he was the favourite. So they were all up against it, and they didn't really have an answer.
A community around the world, stories and films with the most compelling characters, the world's finest apparel, explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
I'm Simon from Rafa. At Rafa, we believe that cycling transforms lives and that riding's the answer to many of our daily problems and challenges. We have 23 Rafa clubhouses around the world, and we host 300 rides a week with thousands of people. So wherever you are, we invite you to ride with us. See rafa.cc to find a ride near you.
thank you very much to our headline sponsor, Rafa. My job this morning at the start was to present the coveted Pedlar de Charme t-shirt designed and made by Rafa to John Degenkolb of Trek Segafredo, who won our listeners' poll to claim the title of Pedlar de Charme for week two of the Tour de France. He emerged from his bus with a little casquette on with the peak up, looking every inch the Pedlar de Charme, has to be said.
A little confusion over why he won. I mean, we can't guess the motivation of the voters, but it wasn't just for winning the Roubaix stage, was it?
He promised £350 million a week to the NHS. it was a tweet that briefly appeared in the Cycling Podcast account. It wasn't that. I think largely it was the other day the Dimension data writer Jay Thompson put a tweet out that John Degenkolb had. He dropped his sunglasses on a climb and Degenkolb had picked them up and given them back to him. And in the tweet, he said that Degenkolb was one of the most well-liked riders in the peloton, which, you know, you don't always hear these bits of insight. Occasionally a rider will do something and other riders will come out and say, you know, that he's popular in the group. And that was obviously, that was also apparent after he won the Roubaix stage, Degenkolb. So, I mean, all in all, and I think a lot of people, you know, the win was a return to the form that he had a couple of years ago before his dreadful accident. He's had a long and at times painful return from that. So lots of reasons, I think, why Degenkolb was the winner of Pedal de Charme. But I did say to him that the Pedal de Charme Award is not just about, you know, winning and riding well. It's for other gestures and other things as well. So I asked him about the incident where he picked up Thompson's glasses. Here's what he said this morning. The award is actually more for your act in picking up Jay Thompson's glasses the other day than, I think, winning the stage. It was an interesting tweet from him.
Yeah, he was almost losing them. So, like, luckily I was slow enough on that climb to just grab it while riding.
Is that right? You were able to pick them up without stopping?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I couldn't have stopped there for sure. There was no way I could have stopped.
He said you're one of the most well liked riders in the peloton. Was that something you were aware of?
It was for sure a nice tweet, and I really appreciate his opinion.
How have you enjoyed this tour? I mean, for you to get that stage win, confirmation that you're, you know, back to the level you were at, I suppose, you must be relieved and happy and satisfied about that.
Absolutely, I'm super happy, and it's been a great tour so far, and yeah, yesterday we came close again with Jasper, and I think the whole spirit in the team is really high, and it's a big advantage to the other teams that we try to grab every day as a big chance, and it's nice to see.
Very few sprinters left. I mean, are any other opportunities for you, do you think?
I mean, there are not so many sprints left, so basically only two in Po and in Paris, but yeah, I think especially on the Champs-Élysées, it would be nice to win there, for sure.
Some very charming, not pedalling, but some charming picking up and handing back from John Degenkolb then.
While still moving, he didn't even stop. Amazing.
Wow.
Lend down and whoosh, scoop them up.
Yeah, that really is charming.
It's like a sort of cycling proficiency test, isn't it? In schools where they would do sort of limbo dancing under bars and things like that.
And you can tell when in the morning, every time John Degenkolb goes past and goes to the podium, he always kind of, you know, claps hands with the other riders. He's obviously very popular with the peloton. Yeah.
Well, a bit of a day off for the GC riders, really. Not a day off as in not a rest day, but not a day of high stress and tension. All very controlled by Team Sky today. Had everybody on the front looking after Geraint Thomas and Chris Froome. They've now got a rest day in the Carcassonne Campanile Hotel, Richard. And you were looking through the road book to see where the teams are staying. Groupama FDJ are staying in some enormous chateau in the beautiful countryside.
A fabulous wedding venue by the looks of things. Hopefully the rough justice there would be if there's a really loud wedding going on tonight, I guess.
And Team Sky are in a Campanile, which is a kind of a lower end budget hotel, pretty functional sort of place. And when you posted these pictures on Twitter, somebody then said, is this also the venue for the French Town Criers National Championships taking place this evening?
I think it's just level people in the field. You know, the richest teams got the poorest, you know, the most miserable hotels, and the poorest teams get the chateaus. I mean, that's France. Liberté, égalité, fraternité. Yeah.
The bigger the team budget, the worse the accommodation. So next year, Team Sky are camping.
Sleeping in their cars.
Well, anyway.
Yeah, on the subjects of Team Sky, François spoke to Nicolas Portal, the sports director at Team Sky, a Frenchman. It was a very amusing moment in this interview where Portal obviously can't quite believe he's talking to you in English, and it all seems a bit odd, so we'll hear that as well. But some really fascinating insights, I think, in this little conversation you had with Portal at the finish today.
Is it possible that we see Wout pulls a little bit more in the Pyrenees?
The plan also for us was to try to don't use that much Wout, and if he can come here, coming up on a really good form in the Pyrenees, because you never know. I mean, Kiato is doing really well. Egan also, but he's 21 years old. So the plan was to have in case, vous me posez la question en français ou en anglais?
En anglais, vas-y.
Ah, sorry.
J'ai le même problème.
No, because I was looking, in case Egan or Kiato getting tired, and we hope Wout will be our key guy, especially with them maybe on the short stage on the 65k kilometers.
Yeah, because as you said, Egan is 21, first tour. I mean, can he last three weeks? I mean, that's the main question for you. Garen was talking about the big unknown, but the third week is a big unknown for Egan. It's a big unknown for Chris because he's done the Giro, and a big unknown for G because he's never done it.
Yeah, and it's the same thing also for Dumoulin. You know, he's done the Giro also. So listen, with all the if nobody has answer, so everybody, each team got the plan, and of course each team think they got the right plan, so let's see. And something are also it's important, like it's not only about Froome and G, there's some other guys really strong, so, and it could happen the same thing that happened to Yes for us next week, you know, because every day we've been racing quite hard, so it's never been like an easy race. And even if you have a big strong teammate, in a way, other GC contenders just use our teammate. You know, so I heard like few days ago some riders saying like we have a strong team, but sometimes where for all the big GC contenders, actually we're just pulling for them, and if they want to attack, they can use our train, you know. Obviously it's better for us to have some strong support, but you can use this also when you're on other teams.
You mentioned Tom Dumoulin because everybody does, but how about Lotto Jumbo? They've been racing quite a very interesting team race.
Of course. And I mean, what did a couple of days ago Cross Week? I need to say I was quite impressed. Everyone. Going up until 6:10, and he didn't drop down quickly. He was maintaining this like for a long time, and behind the guys was really pushing. It's being a big show, and for sure he got some legs. And it seems like Crosswick doing this when he's on a high altitude on a big long mountain stages, and we need to watch out a little bit, because on this long stage in the Pyrenees, when you do Tourmalet, Aspin, later on you got all the climbs and Soulorobisque. That's exactly the kind of stage that Crosswick could be good, and Roglic obviously, is someone's going to be probably one of the best in the future and soon.
Another big unknown is the Movistar. We never know what to expect from them.
True. But I need to say I'm a bit confused with them, how they race. So, yeah.
So that was Nicolas Portal. What was interesting there was, you know, just little nuggets about they're conscious of, although they have this incredible strength, they might just be doing the work for other leaders, you know, who don't have such strong teams, especially, I think, Dumoulin. The other point he made was about the threat of Lotto NL Jumbo and how impressed they were by Kruijswijk. And the other point was a point you made last night, Lionel, that Wout Poels, who's been very quiet so far this tour and did ride the Giro, they've, I think, been saving him, you know, not being confident that Egan Bernal, who's 21 years old. And we got some pronunciation lessons on Egan. Egan. Ebygum. I don't know.
He's not from York.
Egan Bernal. Anyway, they're not confident, obviously, his 21-year-old legs will last into the Pyrenees as well as they did in the Alps. And so we could see quite a lot of white poles this coming week.
And just while we're kind of analysing every tiny little thing for hints and clues as to how Chris Froome and Geraint Thomas are getting on, one thing we spotted the other day was our friend Simon, the photographer, Simon Gill, took an absolutely belting photograph of Chris Froome going through Dutch Corner. There's kind of some smoke from a flare. Chris Froome and the little chapel in the background. And Chris Froome, with permission, posted this on his social media. He actually cropped out Geraint Thomas from that photograph.
Who was ahead?
Who was just ahead of him. Geraint, in the actual photograph, Geraint Thomas is just ahead of Chris Froome. I'm sure this was purely because on Instagram you have to have a square photo. I'm sure that's why it is. Oh, yeah.
No, you don't.
Oh, definitely.
Interesting.
Oh, give him the benefit of the doubt.
It's a beautiful... The picture worked perfectly with the two of them in it. It was nicely framed with the church and everything, and... It was a good spot that
every picture tells a story, and yeah. There's the four-time winner on the wheel of the yellow jersey. Well, in Chris Froome's reality, the yellow jersey didn't exist.
I wonder if he angrily cropped out Geraint Thomas.
Well, one of the interesting things I found, you mentioned it, Richard, in Nicolas Portal's little chat with me, was Movistar. Because remember, it's a long time ago, 2 weeks ago, we thought Movistar had leaders' problem. They had three leaders.
They've certainly got leaders' problem now, haven't they?
Absolutely. And the thing is, nobody mentioned them anymore. There's nobody at the bus. Even the Spaniards seem to have given up. And hopefully they're coming on the home terrain in the Pyrenees.
Yeah.
We can expect. I hope that now their strategy, the tactics get a little bit clearer. And Mikel Landa is not that far. We know he's capable of good things. And hopefully, Movistar will be more understandable to all of us, including Nicolas Portal.
Yeah, I mean, Mikel Landa is 6th overall, 3 minutes 42 behind Geraint Thomas, a couple of minutes behind Chris Froome. Quintana's another 35 seconds back from there. I mean, they've got to do something. They've got to win a stage in this tour as an absolute minimum. So they have to go on the attack.
I think Landa will be better. I think that his crash on the Roubaix stage took a lot out of him, and I don't think we saw Landa at nearly his best in the Alps. And I think he'll be better this week. I can see him setting fire to the short stage that we've got was it Wednesday, the short stage?
Yeah.
I can see him just ripping that to pieces in the same way that he did last year on the stage to Foix, where he was very, very strong. It was also a short stage, and it's his home turf as well, the Pyrenees. So I think we'll see a good Mikel Landa this week, and he's not that far down. He's not out of it. We have been talking about the race as if it's between Chris Froome and Geraint Thomas and Tom Dumoulin. These other guys are not that far away.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
So the voice of Seb Piquet, Race Radio at the Tour de France, reminds me to tell you that today's episode sponsor from the Tour de France is The Economist magazine. Now, The Economist is about far more than just economics and finance. It covers a range of subjects from politics and business to science, technology, arts and the environment. The Economist helps readers prepare for what is going on in the world around them, and in today's dynamic world, facts matter more than ever. For over 170 years, The Economist has delivered trustworthy intelligence that helps people like you choose where to stand on the issues that matter most. Now, Lionel, you've been perusing your Economist today while the stage was unfolding. You could take your eyes off it for a moment or two and find something that you found interesting.
It always interests me when The Economist looks at sport, and one of the stories that caught my eye was about football transfer fees and how when there's a World Cup or a European Championship, the value of players goes up if a player performs well in those tournaments, when really the data says that clubs are being persuaded to overpay because of a player's performance in a major championship, and actually players' value should be based on their performance in regular league seasons. So, and that really kind of caught my eye, because I think there's a lot of parallels there between talent spotting and signing of athletes in professional cycling. Richard, you made an episode of Kilometre Zero about the growing and real wealth of data that's available to people working in professional cycling, not just in terms of rider recruitment, but how races are played out. And I think cycling particularly is only at the tip of the iceberg. Perhaps football, because of all the money that is in the game, is maybe sort of 5, maybe even 10 years ahead in terms of, looking at this real data and detail.
The Economist is a smart guide to the forces changing your world, and you can get a free copy if you're a Cycling Podcast listener. Please do take advantage of this offer if you fancy getting a free print copy. Just text CYCLING to 78070. That's for your free print copy of The Economist. Just text CYCLING to 78070.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Yes, thank you very much to our sponsor, Science and Sport. We're very grateful to them, and they're still offering their 25% off. SISCP25 is the discount, and you can get your discounted products at scienceandsport.com. We know that a lot of you take advantage of the offer because you send us pictures of all your swag, your goodies. But Science and Sport, as much as we love them, they've still not produced your Castellet gels, have they, Lionel?
They haven't.
I mean, we're in Castellet country. Maybe you could collect some samples here.
Maybe, yeah. Take that. Do you think some samples of Castellet in the Cycling Podcast car is a good idea with this heat?
Beautifully clean car today. We went through a car wash today, deliberately.
Yeah.
And it's looking absolutely gleaming, the car.
Good job too, because some listeners were standing by the car as we came back to it this evening, and it's a good job we got that bird poo off the side, isn't it?
Well, that's a whole other story, Lionel, and I don't think it reflects all that well on you.
Let's just clear this up. I'm not sure we've talked about this, have we? We were told a couple of nights ago to park in a specific space at our hotel. They had a car park with a gate, and the lady asked, please do park in our allocated spaces, not anywhere else. So I said this to Richard. Richard was very unsure because it was under trees.
No, I wasn't unsure. I was absolutely convinced that we should not park under trees.
Well, I was...
Because when you park under trees, you wake up in the morning with bird poo on your car.
Yeah. And then Francois said, oh, don't worry, birds don't live in plane trees, whatever plane trees are. Anyway, the following morning...
We've got plane trees just over the across the road there, you know.
Absolutely.
And no birds.
Anyway, when we came down the following morning, I was going to be the passenger, Richard was driving.
Well, this was a beautiful moment, because Francois and I got to the car first. We inspected it for bird poo. It didn't appear to be any on it. Then we walked around the corner, and lo and behold, the only place it was on the passenger door handle. So Francois and I climbed in, Francois into the back, me in the driver's seat, laughing a little bit to ourselves, knowing that we were going to pick up Lionel a moment and he was going
to... I had to use the bird pooey handle. the irony is, it was actually Francois who was the casting vote on where we should park.
So no, it's his
no,
fault.
But the birds know of that course, Francois yeah. lives in his little nest. They see him as one
right,
of their
yeah.
own.
But I'm very tidy in my little nest, and there's a sequel to it, because this morning we actually found bird's poo almost on the same spot again, not because we parked under a plane tree, but because we park under a wire, an electric yeah. cable. So don't park anywhere where near
park
a bird.
Under sky.
Avoid birds.
Anyway, we've got all that sorted out, and our car is a beautiful Skoda Karoq,
yeah.
supplied by Skoda. Thank you to them.
Mm-hmm.
And on the subject of Skoda, I spent the day with Andy Schleck on Saturday. He's working with Skoda, and I interviewed him over many hours, and that will come out as Tuesday's Kilometre Zero. And it was really fascinating. So fascinating, in fact, that we're going to also make it into an extended Friends special episode to come out after the Tour de France.
Good shout, yeah.
Anyway, well, on with the race. You spoke this morning, I think, Lionel, to Frans Maassen of Lotto NL Jumbo, who we expect a lot of this final week.
Well, we do. They've got two riders in the top seven, Primoz Roglic in fourth and Steven Krauswijk in seventh. And we've seen Krauswijk go for a real long one on the stage to Alpe d'Huez over the Croix de Fer, and we've seen Roglic be aggressive on the Côte de la Croix Neuve on the way up above Mond. And so, well, I wanted to know how aggressive we can expect Lotto NL Jumbo to be in the Pyrenees. Franz, we saw Primoz Roglic look very strong on the climb. Does that suggest that he'll be good in the Pyrenees?
I think so. He promised all year that he is steady and healthy and strong. So, yeah, we expect that he also last week will do a good job.
And tactically, how are you working it with Krauswijk and Roglic? Because Krauswijk did so much on Alpe d'Huez, Roglic yesterday. What tactically, what can you do?
Yeah, to be honest, this was two times the freedom from the guys to do what they did. They showed what they showed, and for Primoz is and also for Steven it's important to stay on the same level. And yeah, we see. We may want to try to make him as hard as possible last week. The three big stars in front of us. And maybe one of them has a bad day one day.
Last year, Roglic won a stage in the last week. It's a very different situation now, trying to ride for the podium.
Yeah, maybe, but it was possible that he won the stage yesterday. Unfortunately, there were 32 guys in the break. It was not, but we hoped for a break with seven guys. But then there was a possibility that we could still challenge for the stage victory, but he showed that he could do it. So, and he had it in his mind because it was a little bit of climb like in Baskeland. And but yeah, it was now for the 28th place, but it could have been worked for also for the stage.
And how do you think about trying to challenge Sky? I mean, they look so strong in the mountains, but you've got two guys who are always there too.
Yeah, we hope that one day the Sky train will explode a little bit. But it's really, really difficult because they're really big stars. But we hope they have one bad day, and we hope to do something then.
And lastly, you have a young rider who people were probably seeing at this level for the first time, Antoine Tolhoek. What can you tell us about him?
Yeah, he showed in California and also in the Dauphiné that he's special, and it worked for him that he's now in the Tour, and he showed here already that he's also special, and I think in the last week he looks really fresh, and we see him as a big helper for our Tour leaders.
Sky are using Egan Bernal so much. Does that surprise you? And how do you judge how much work to give Tolhoek?
We don't give him so much special, I think, like Bernal, but we are not in the lead, so we can see it from the second row. Therefore, sometimes he can let it go at the last climb or the more easier stages. He can save some energy there. Like today, he's really important on the small climb and the final climb. So he has to be there when the car is not in the neighbourhood.
So that was Frans Maassen, one of the sports directors at Lotto NL Jumbo. The thing about this is that at a certain point, they will settle for what they have. It's just where that point is, because two riders in the top seven, they'll both want good results here. It's not to be sniffed at. If somebody says, "Oh, would you like to finish fourth or fifth in the Tour de France during your career?" 95% of riders would take that, and so that defensiveness creeps in, especially as the fatigue kind of begins to rise in the final week.
But it also depends on how they perceive the others to be going. You know, if they, you know, Roglic attacked yesterday and got the gap and made some time when he is a danger, and from that he will draw a lot of encouragement, and he's done it already this year. He's won big races and he's beaten these guys, and so I think that when there's an obvious, and there has been quite a lot recently, and there often is in the Tour, a really obvious guy leading the race with a strong team supporting him, that becomes a very difficult proposition to take on. I think they see here a Geraint Thomas who is unproven over 3 weeks and could crack, Chris Froome who is a slightly vulnerable, not quite the same Froome there has been, and Tom Dumoulin who similarly is kind of unproven, certainly backing up a Grand Tour, and Froome and Dumoulin both come from the Giro, and there's that unknown as well, just how the Giro will affect those two in the final week.
Yeah, well, obviously Lotto Jumbo are one of the teams, and probably the team that could unsettle I'm not going to say the Team Sky plan, because the way things are going, you can't really say it's a plan, but they say it repeatedly, but are in an ideal position. One and two, it remains to be seen, and it's very, you know, doubtful that Chris Froome will attack Geraint Thomas, or that Geraint Thomas will attack Chris Froome. They can play sort of a waiting race now, actually, and it's up to the others to try something, and if somebody is going to try something, probably it will be Lotto Jumbo, and hopefully it might inspire others, Movistar, and maybe, you know, Romain Bardet, Dan Martin, the kind of lone rangers of the peloton now, to try something as well. And maybe, you know, this kind of fireworks will probably inspire what the Team Sky tactics are going to be.
Ultimately the race will come down to who's the best of those team leaders. We talk a lot about Team Sky and their strength, but Kwiatkowski, Wout Poels, Egan Bernal, they're not going to win the race for Froome or Thomas, because we've seen already Froome and Thomas cannot get rid of Tom Dumoulin. And Roglic is still a threat too. So, and I think we got this from what Portal said, that actually those strong Team Sky domestiques are kind of doing Dumoulin's job for him. You know, they are effectively doing the job. As he said, they're acting as a train for the other guys. So Team Sky have got a bit of a, it's not a problem, but it's by no means certain. They're not just riding to Paris, you know, putting men on the front and giving Froome and Thomas and Armstrong a ride to Paris. Not at all. It's going to come down to, you know, who's the strongest out of those guys when it's just those guys left.
And my impression as well is that, you know, the old time when some teams and some riders, you know, were content with finishing second or third or fourth or fifth have gone. My impression is really Roglic will not be riding for second or third. Dumoulin obviously won't be riding for second or third. Romain Bardet, you know, is not riding for a podium place. He's done it already. He wants more. So they can really try, even from time to time, kind of suicidal attempts to unsettle Sky. And, well, you know, we could have a real, really, really interesting last week.
We could. Our mood has changed a little bit from that first day in the Alps, isn't it? Rosière, where we thought this, you know, the signs were quite ominous at that point. But I think we're looking at a more open race. Now, another guy I bumped into this morning at the start, riding down to sign on, was Ian Boswell. And he approached me on the bike looking quite anxious. So I stopped him and asked him why. Ian Boswell is keeping an audio diary for us at this tour. His team's down to four riders now. They're having a bit of a shocker. But I'd say we'll hear now why Ian looked quite so ashen-faced this morning.
Well, stage 15 at the start and everyone's warming up, and I'm not warming up, but I'm supposed to be in the breakaway, so I'm a little bit worried.
You look worried, Ian. Well, we're maybe a bit of wind today as well as forecast. Did you know about that?
It was windy yesterday in the start, and I was like one of the first guys to get blown out the back. Yeah, well, I think the final as well, this last 17K, you know, I think once we come down to Carcassonne, it's could be windy and there's not much, I think it's just vineyard. So, you know, if it's a small group, it could be a bit easier for people to stay up there. But if there's still a big team, then someone could rip it apart.
If your job is to get in the breakaway, how do you feel about that? Does that fill you with excitement, apprehension?
Stress. I mean, we only have four riders in the race. So, you know, it's myself or Pavel to make it in the breakaway, which, you know, decreases your odds of making it, having four guys. You know, Zacharin obviously is here for the GC and trying to move up, and Niels is a big dude, so goodness, man. Yeah, a little bit stressed, to be honest, just thinking about trying to be there and watch these FDJ guys. I mean, FDJ's warming up on trainers. When what's happened? You know, Marc Madio's taking the piss out of cycling, that something's gone wrong, they've lost his character, and here his team is warming up on turbo trainers. I mean, it's true, isn't it? I mean, everyone likes to complain about everyone else and, you know, talk about Sky and they're changing the sport, but everyone's taking part. Except for us. No one mentioned turbo trainers for us.
Well, you'll be fresh. These guys look knackered to me.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they're just doing it to survive, but I mean, I saw Kofidis warming up on trainers, and, you know, I think it's a big...
mental warfare, isn't it?
Exactly. Well, and maybe this podcast will be my warm-up. Getting my heart rate up.
So that was Ian Boswell. Sadly, he didn't make it into the break, but it's difficult when you've only got, you know, two guys on the team whose job that is, and we'll hear in his audio diary exactly how the day unfolded.
Well, it must be Cassoulet o'clock, Richard.
Oh, it's always Cassoulet o'clock in Carcassonne, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do we have a bit of French flavour today, Francois?
Well, I mean, you mentioned Cassoulet at least 12 times, and bird poo as well, so it's very difficult to add some, you know, more French flavour to that, and curry as well. The only thing I can maybe add to that is, if you've been watching TV, you've seen that the ramparts of La Cité de Carcassonne, of the old town, are painted in red. In yellow, excuse me, I mentioned in yellow. It's not actually an homage to Geraint Thomas, as far as I know. And it's funny because the shape of the way the yellow paint is placed on the ramparts looks a little bit haphazard, a little bit strange and kind of random. It's not at all, actually. It's an artist who painted these yellow patches, and when you come in from the motorway at a very precise point, you can see a very straight yellow stretch crossing the ramparts, so that's a, you know, kind of visual effect. So if you were wondering why that is, well, that's the answer.
Great, well, let's leave it for now and go and eat. Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Francois.
Merci.
You have been listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2018 Tour de France. Thanks to our sponsors, Rafa and Science in Sport. The music is by Santoré. This episode was produced by Will Jones.